Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. As many of us deal with what seems to be a never-ending string of days of scorching heat, we thank our lucky stars for air conditioning. What better time to pause and consider its history, which is what Talking History's Fred Nielsen will be doing this week with his guest, Marcia Ackerman. And after that, Ira Chernus, a regular on Talking History, returns to talk about the Middle East conflict and what he refers to as the double legacy of the Six-Day War. But first, Joey Skidmore takes a look at an important event that occurred this week in history.
On August 20, 1940, Leon Trotsky was murdered in Mexico City. Trotsky was born Lev Bronstein in 1879 in the Ukraine. He was an outstanding student at a German school in Odessa, but he was soon attracted to Marxism and in 1898 was arrested for the first time for revolutionary activities. He was exiled to Siberia, from which he escaped using a forged passport under the name Leon Trotsky. It was during this period abroad, while living in London, that he met Vladimir Lenin. In 1905, Trotsky returned to Russia, only to be arrested and banished again. This time he did not return until May 1917 after the overthrow of Tsar Nicholas II. Trotsky became a member of the Bolshevik Party and one of the chief organizers of the October Revolution, which brought the Bolsheviks to power. He became People's Commissar for Foreign Affairs under Party Secretary Vladimir Lenin, but he clashed with fellow Bolshevik Joseph Stalin. When Lenin died and Stalin gained control of the party and country, Trotsky was charged with treason and ordered to leave the country. He took up residence in Mexico City, where on August 20, 1940, he was killed by a Spanish communist who is suspected to have been an agent of Joseph Stalin.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, three distinct groups of early humans may have migrated from Africa and lived together in Eurasia at the same time, according to a report recently published in the journal Science. Researchers report having uncovered fossils in the Republic of Georgia from three different primitive human groups, long believed to have lived in different time periods, all dating to about 1.7 million years ago. And it might not have been hot chocolate with marshmallows, but the Mayans were drinking chocolate as early as 600 BC. New research on the subject, based on an examination of remains found inside some ceramic vessels unearthed in Kola, Belize, and published in the journal Nature, pushes back Mayan chocolate drinking almost 1,000 years. The Mayans associated chocolate with wealth and power, but it was nevertheless a bitter brew, as compared to our own, because they had not discovered sugar. This is Talking History. Any nation has welcomed the invention of air conditioning, it's the United States, the most air-conditioned country in the world. And this year we celebrate the 100th anniversary of the installation of the country's first mechanical air conditioning system. All of this has prompted University of Nebraska at Omaha's Professor of History, Fred Nielsen, sitting in his air-conditioned studio, to investigate the history of that which keeps him cool with his guest, Marcia Ackerman.
It was the birth of the cool. In 1902, the first mechanical air conditioning system was installed in a Brooklyn printing plant. Eventually, Americans would put air conditioning in their trains, buses, automobiles, theaters, department stores, offices, and homes. Indeed, almost everywhere. In the century since that first installation, the United States has become the most air-conditioned society in the world. Here to discuss that development and the changes it has brought is Marcia Ackerman, a member of the History Department at Eastern Michigan University and the author of Cool Comfort, America's Romance with Air Conditioning. Professor Ackerman, welcome.
Oh, thank you.
One of the key figures in the development of air conditioning was Willis Carrier. Could you tell us a little bit about him?
Willis Carrier is probably one of the main reasons why I got interested in air conditioning, because he came from the same place I did, which is Buffalo, New York. And as amazing as it may sound to people who only hear about Buffalo in the winter, the fact is that that's where air conditioning was invented in 1902, before it was installed in that Brooklyn plant. Willis Carrier was born on a farm in a suburb southeast of Buffalo. He became an engineer at Cornell University and came back to Buffalo to work for a fan and blower company, where he came upon the idea that there may be a way of controlling both heat and humidity by the application of the proper physical principle. He was also a very successful businessman, forming what was certainly and may still be the largest air conditioning company in the world, and certainly the one that is most closely identified with the industry overall.
In those early days, it wasn't enough just to try to get rid of heat and humidity to make people more comfortable. You talk about people in the 1920s, pundits of various stripes, who thought that air conditioning was the path to America's physical, mental, and moral progress.
Well, the idea was that there was a theory of climate and civilization that was extremely popular in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. It was part, really, of the whole tendency towards imperialism, to the conquest of what were considered to be less developed nations by places like England and France and the United States. And just one of the justifications for that imperialism was the idea that these white Europeans were spreading true civilization to backwards peoples. And one of the reasons why these peoples were perceived to be backwards was that they lived in climates that were just too hot. And in fact, the Anglo-Saxon idea, which was propounded by people like Teddy Roosevelt, the president, was that cold was the reason why the European races, why the white race, had become so successful. By overcoming cold and by learning to live in the briskness of the cold climate, they had become the world's strongest and most civilized people. And a place like America, that had a very extreme climate, quite unlike that climate of Europe, the idea was that somehow there was a danger that white people would lose that civilized cutting edge, and therefore something had to be done to keep the heat under control.
When and how do most Americans encounter air conditioning for the first time?
The same way that most of us probably do today, actually, which is at the movies. In the early years of air conditioning, the first 20 years or so, the uses of air conditioning were primarily industrial. In other words, the idea was not to make people comfortable. The idea was that manufacturing processes could be undertaken much more reliably if both temperature and humidity could be controlled, even in some cases if it meant making an interior of a factory much warmer. As long as the humidity was at the right level, this would actually help the process to be more effective. For example, in that 1902 Brooklyn printing plant, this was a place that printed a humor magazine called Judge, and they found in the summer that the ink was actually sliding off the pages of their magazine. And when Carrier came in with his combination of a device that controlled both heat and humidity, he made the temperature 80 degrees, which is not generally what's considered comfortable by modern standards, but he reduced the humidity to 55%, and the ink stayed on the page. So for the first 20 years or so, various kinds of industries discovered that their processes worked better with air conditioning. And not until the 20s, when the movie makers started realizing that they were trying to appeal to a larger, more middle-class audience, and they were desperately trying to find a way to lure people into their theaters in the summertime, that they began to install air conditioning. And it was, as the movies were, air conditioning was an enormous success in the 20s.
One of the things that struck me about your book is that although it clearly costs more to air condition than not to air condition, the people who could afford it the most, the upper classes, don't embrace it at first. Department stores air condition their bargain basements, but not their upper levels with the pricier clothes. Franklin Roosevelt, a patrician, oversaw the air conditioning of government offices during the 30s, but he actively avoided using it himself. Was there some sort of class bias against air conditioning?
I think we could characterize air conditioning even now as an extremely middle-class development in comfort. Nobody has ever particularly worried about whether poor people are comfortable in our country. And on the other hand, rich people ideologically believed that they were, because they were wealthy, they were also more immune to the ordinary distresses of the body. In other words, that they were not susceptible to feeling hot or cold. And if they did feel uncomfortable, they had the training and the sort of the British idea of stiff upper lip They were gritty enough not to complain about it. In fact, of course, one of the reasons why the wealthy did not worry or think about the heat as much as middle-class people or poor people who were otherwise being ignored was that they had much bigger houses. These houses had lots of windows. They had servants to do the hard, hot, and heavy work for them. And in the summertime, they had other places to go, to the mountains or to the seashore, where, of course, it would be much cooler and more comfortable. And, of course, they didn't need air conditioning because they had other ways of making themselves feel better. And it was like Theodore Roosevelt had done, saying that, of course, Anglo-Saxons were the people who were the best, you know, invigorated by a cold climate. He also thought his idea of manliness and sort of just general human strength forbade the people, the upper classes, of admitting to any kind of discomfort, including that from heat. So his cousin, FDR, had grown up in this kind of environment, you know, where you would go to the country in the summer. In fact, one of the sad ironies of this is that one of his summer escapes to Campobello was where he contracted the polio that afflicted him, of course, for the rest of his life. But he continued to prefer, actually, to sweat, or perhaps we should say perspire for an upper-class person, even as he was encouraging the city of Washington during the Depression to install air conditioning as much as possible.
Well, that raises another point. Washington, D.C., of course, is hot and humid in the summer. It's built on a swamp, after all. There have been some observers over the years who've tried to connect the rise of active government to the installation of air conditioning there. For example, in your book, you quote Gore Vidal to the effect that since air conditioning arrived in Washington, D.C., Congress sits and sits while the presidents and their staffs never stop making mischief. How much truth is there in that?
Some, definitely. Air conditioning came to Washington, D.C., which, of course, had been listed as a tropical posting by the British Foreign Service. British ambassadors that came to Washington were given extra pay for the hard duty of being in a place like Washington, D.C. in the summer. But in 1928, the House and Senate finally agreed with each other that it was time to air condition the chambers in which they sat in the U.S. Capitol. And in fact, it was the Carrier Corporation that won the contract to install this major, major air conditioning project. The fact was it was extremely controversial because the congressman did not want to be perceived as putting their comfort ahead of the taxpayers' money, or, in fact, putting comfort ahead of the idea that what they were doing was hard and work and not some kind of luxurious pastime going on in Washington. It did help Congress to stay in session longer, but there are many examples from the 19th and early 20th centuries, well before air conditioning, where congressmen would, in fact, stay in Washington even when it got really hot because they had not finished their work. So it did not alone make Congress sit and make mischief, but it certainly helped them feel more comfortable while they did it.
Air conditioning seems to have been marketed differently to men and women. What explains that difference?
Yes, the gender aspects of air conditioning are fascinating. The irony is that it has been actually proven in endless lab experiments that women prefer being warmer, a little bit warmer, than men do. And this seems to be true even if we adjust for the fact that certainly in these years like the 20s and 30s, men tended to wear far more clothing than women did, jackets and suits and so on. So even adjusting for clothing, women tend to prefer to be a slightly warmer than men do. They're more tolerant of heat. Nobody knows exactly why physiologically, at least I don't know, but this is true. The idea was that women needed air conditioning to preserve their purity, their health, and to promote the happiness of their families. And as we get into the 50s and people start trying to sell air conditioning for the home, the big argument to make women want to have it, women who basically don't like to be cold and are going to be home all day with this cold machine going, the idea that they could still cook full course hot dinners for their family in the middle of July and August was a huge selling point. And the purity issue was one where when they were out in the movies or if they were at the department store, that in fact the air conditioning would protect them from the sort of the sweaty emanations of the public throng. Don't forget that for women, going out in public by themselves was something relatively new in the 20s, and even into the 50s was not as common as it is today. So women were sort of told they would be protected by air conditioning from being with the masses. Men, on the other hand, were supposed to have air conditioning to enhance their productivity and their efficiency. If they were in their office, they would be able to work better, work harder, and leave work refreshed, perhaps by traveling in an air-conditioned train. This would mean that they would do better work for themselves, for their families, and for their employers. So it wasn't an indulgence, in other words, and this is one of the arguments in Washington, it was necessary to the better functioning of America's business.
Lots of people like it for different reasons. Your subtitle refers to America's romance with air conditioning, and yet there have been vociferous critics of it who see air conditioning as a nightmare. What was their objection?
Well, like all romances, this one has had its ups and downs. One of the people who I use quite a lot, who criticized air conditioning, was Henry Miller, the famously pornographic writer who spent much of his life in France before eventually coming back to the United States and retiring out to California, where he finally was able to get some of his books published, such as Tropic of Cancer and Tropic of Capricorn, that had been banned for years in the United States. And he wrote a book in the 1940s called The Air-Conditioned Nightmare. And what it was a slashing critique of everything American. He hardly ever talked about actual air conditioning in his book. But it seems that he saw air conditioning as a metaphor for everything in America that was lacking in passion, lacking in feeling and passion, which, of course, was sort of the basis of his whole literary career. There were other critics, and the person who's springing to mind right now, someone I also talk about, Vance Packard, who wrote popular books attacking advertising and other kinds of American consumerism that he thought were dangerous. And he wasn't interested so much in passion. He was interested in the ways in which Americans wastefully indulge themselves. And air conditioning becomes a symbol of this wasteful indulgence and the idea of luxury over simplicity, of instead of accepting things the way they are, of using an expensive machine to try to make things better, and as a status symbol. He was a person who was very much a critic of status symbols for their own sake.
We have only about a minute or so remaining, so I'll give you a question that can't possibly be answered in that time.
Okay.
As we've mentioned before, America's now had air conditioning for about a century. How has that 100 years of air conditioning changed America?
Well, about 83% of the houses in America are now air conditioned. About 98 or 99% of cars now come with air conditioning, even though you usually still have to pay extra for it. There are far more buildings that don't have windows that open because we don't feel that we need a way other than machinery to adjust the temperature and the climate inside these buildings. This has had both good and bad consequences. I think Americans are much more acclimated to air conditioning than they are to not. There's a classroom building at the University of Michigan, which is just a few miles from where I live, that was built in the early 50s when air conditioning was available. And there was no air conditioning installed, and I know this because I myself took graduate classes there, and it was quite warm in the summer. They are now in the process of renovating that building, and now they're putting in air conditioning. Because when people have it in their cars, and they have it in their houses, and almost all offices have it, and they go to air-conditioned movies, they are not prepared to have a part of the day where they have to actually sweat. And I think it's changed things in that way. It also has saved some lives in heat waves. There is no question that in the olden days it was accepted that in the summer dozens, if not hundreds, of people would die, usually the poorest, humblest members of society, This is less common now, although it still happens, because like any other technology, air conditioning is not distributed with perfect fairness to everybody who needs it.
Well, Professor Ackerman, thanks so much for visiting with us.
Well, thank you.
I've been speaking with Marcia Ackerman, author of Cool Comfort, America's Romance with Air Conditioning.
The Six-Day War is often seen as just another part of a half-century-long conflict between Israel, its Arab neighbors, and Palestinians. But as Ira Chernus tells us, the Six-Day War was important for another reason as well, closer to home.
35 years ago, Israel won the Six-Day War. That was the fateful week when concerns about Israel and the Holocaust moved to the center of U.S. Jewish life. Before 1967, Jews here had found a level of security unprecedented in the history of the diaspora. They did not worry so much about threats to Israel or another Holocaust. During the Six-Day War, millions of U.S. Jews felt for the first time that Israel's fate symbolized their own fate. Virtually all Jews claimed that Israel's very existence was threatened, though some historians now question this claim. It seemed only logical to conclude that Jews in the U.S. faced another Holocaust. Rather than celebrate their newfound security, American Jews portrayed themselves as an outpost of an eternally endangered and embattled people. Today, most Jews still embrace a religious vision that has dominated U.S. Judaism since the Six-Day War. The eminent historian of Judaism, Rabbi Jacob Neusner, calls it the Judaism of Holocaust and Redemption. Its prime religious commandment is to ensure Jewish survival by supporting Israel. With Israel the symbol of every Jew's fate, only the army of Israel, it seems, stands between survival and another Holocaust. Jews can easily see their acts of self-assertion as morally valid, even when those acts are deadly military strikes. This gives Israel's military actions a seemingly irrefutable ethical and even spiritual legitimacy. In June 1967, U.S. Jews came to define themselves as one of the oppressed peoples of the world. They took on the pride of an oppressed people fighting back to prevent a new Holocaust. Jews still gather to celebrate pride in their Jewish power, which appears to them both military and moral. It is a pride that non-Jewish Americans can readily understand and applaud. This synergy has served Israel's interests well. The Judaism of Holocaust and Redemption still teaches many U.S. Jews who have unprecedented personal safety to imagine themselves as members of an oppressed and therefore insecure people. Out of that imagined insecurity, they support, or at least tolerate, hardline Israeli policies that fuel Palestinian resistance and perpetuate the cycle of violence. Most non-Jewish Americans do the same, and so does their government. The insecurity that grew out of the Six-Day War led many Jews to demand a pro-Israel tilt in U.S. policy, but that tilt, so evident in the Bush administration and in Congress, makes it impossible for the United States to play a role of neutral peacemaker in the Middle East. The special relationship between the United States and Israel now blocks the path to peace. If U.S. Jews need a peaceful and secure Israel in order to feel secure themselves, the attitudes born during the Six-Day War still block the path to their security, too.
You've been listening to Ira Chernus, Professor of Religious Studies at the University of Colorado, Boulder. His commentary comes to us courtesy of the History News Service. Following up on Ira Chernus's remarks, if you're interested in learning more about the Holocaust, Joey Skidmore is back to tell you about the most informative site on that tragic event in the United States.
The United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, located in Washington, D.C., is America's premier institution for the documentation, study, and interpretation of Holocaust history. Chartered by an act of Congress in 1980, the museum is dedicated to disseminating knowledge about the Holocaust and encouraging its visitors to reflect upon the moral and spiritual questions raised by that event. The museum's permanent exhibit, spanning three floors, presents a narrative history using more than 900 artifacts, 7 video monitors, and 4 theaters. The exhibit is divided into 3 parts: Nazi Assault, Final Solution, and last chapter. It begins with images of death and destruction as witnessed by American soldiers during the liberation of Nazi concentration camps in 1945, and leaves us with questions as to our moral obligations in our own time.
Thank you, Joey. And if you visit the Holocaust Museum this summer, you can take in a special exhibit on Oskar Schindler. In 1939, following the German invasion of Poland, the German Catholic industrialist, made popular by the film Schindler's List, moved to Krakow and established an enamel works which became a haven for about 900 Jewish workers, providing them relief from the brutality of the Nazi labor camps. In October 1944, he began another factory in Czechoslovakia, to which he transferred more than 1,000 of his Krakow workers, thereby continuing their humane treatment and ultimately saving their lives. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show. We invite you to send us your comments or suggestions, either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History, University of Missouri, Kansas City, Kansas City, Missouri, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Information about the OAH and Talking History is available at oah.org. And until next time, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.